Hey guys, welcome back to the Anne Marie Show. I'm so glad you are here today. Joining me is Simon Heisler. He is a filmmaker and he created a movie called The Daughters of the West. And we're going to get into what that is on this episode. Please like, share, and subscribe. Join me on Telegram at the Anne Marie Show. Please, again, like, share, and subscribe this episode far and wide. You can join me on True Social Anne Marie, Frank Social Anne Marie, or my Telegram group, The Anne Marie Show. So coming up next is Simon Heisler with Daughters of the West. A filmmaker joining us today. Welcome, Simon Heisler to the program. I'm sorry if I butchered your name.
That's okay. Heisler it is.
Heisler, is that how you pronounce your name?
That's right.
Okay, good. So I'm excited to talk to you today because I enjoy speaking to filmmakers because you know you have this creativity about you. You're doing something, putting your heart and soul in it. And then it's interesting to find the creative process of how you got to where you are today. And so just a little bit of background about you. I know you've done some projects before others, because today we're going to be talking about your film, Daughters of the West. But what are some of the other projects that you've worked on in the past?
Well, before Daughters of the West, I worked on a 6-part docuseries called Superorganism. And the series had sort of two elements to it, two main elements. One was exploring the occulted war on the family. So specific warfare that is directed at destroying the family unit in Western civilization. And so I went through some documents that state actual warfare intentions and map out a warfare strategy designed to remove the family from Western society so that a new world order could be installed. And this is the specific language of this document. They're called the Toronto Protocols. So that's one element of the docuseries. The other is looking at the family unit, the traditional family unit, as a superorganism that is designed to gather human wisdom, preserve it, and send it to future generations. And I was curious about this because I feel that putting powerful cultural ideals into our society that represent the family unit in this way is an excellent way to fight back, and doing it in a way that is based on available science and psychology and certain spiritual concepts makes it broadly accessible. So while it supports the traditional Christian notion of the family unit, I actually presented it in a way where it's accessible to everyone by looking at, you know, the biology of the mother, the biology of the father, what happens when a man gets a woman pregnant, how biology actually speaks to the process of gathering human knowledge and wisdom, and how that happens uniquely when a man and a woman produce a baby. So the series contrasted this occulted war on the family with this concept of the family as a superorganism. And when I was doing the research for that film, I was looking at the specific warfare in this war on the family that's targeting the mother, specific warfare targeting the father, and specific warfare targeting the children. And one of the unavoidable things that I came up against was gender ideology. And that seemed to be one of the major things targeting children, especially here in Canada. It's very far along in terms of how saturated Canadian society is. And so that was where I really picked up the research thread on gender ideology. I ended up gathering more research than I could possibly fit in that docuseries. And I ended up in that rabbit hole, found out that girls are disproportionately affected by all of this. And just based on how I experienced our culture growing up, the way I saw it affecting women, it always disturbed me, even as a teenager. I wanted to dig deeper into this. And that was my impulse. And then I ended up uncovering this plastic surgery connection and some of these broader things that are targeting young girls and making it so hard for them to develop into healthy women.
Man, your films sound fascinating. Where do we find your docuseries at?
That docuseries can be watched on a platform called Dauntless Dialogue. If you go to dauntlessdialogue.com, you'll be able to access all 6 episodes there. And I have some other work on there. I also have a film that I wrote called Vague Rules.
Okay.
And this this actually has some really interesting crossover with my film Daughters of the West, because it looks at the ways that communist warfare was imported into the West. It bases this on the history of communist China and the communist revolution there. And it looks at three things in the ways that this warfare style is used to implement critical race theory, gender ideology, mm-hmm. and the COVID lockdowns. And essentially, communist warfare often uses very vague rules and laws to create a specific set of psychological conditions that program humans to behave in certain ways. And so we see that across the board with CRT, gender ideology, and the COVID lockdowns and the COVID culture in general that was put in place. And so that film ties together these warfare strategies through those three seemingly separate things. And actually, people who rent or purchase Daughters of the West through daughtersofthewestfilm.com, as a bonus feature of purchasing that, you'll also get to screen Vague Rules as well.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. You know, I find it fascinating that you have picked up on a lot of this about tying what's happening to communism, because in my research, I found that to be true. They are using racial fights between whites and blacks, especially because they wanted to put division into the country, because if they can put division, it's an easier thing to conquer. The other thing that you said that was very fascinating that I also believe is to be true with communism is they attack the family. My college professor, I studied journalism, but I also did sociology. And I had a brilliant professor. I wish I knew his name. I loved his class, but I cannot remember his name. And he said, if you want to weaken society, you weaken the family unit. And then it's easier for another nation to come and conquer your nation when you have a weak society. And he talked about communism. In his class, he talked about when you have a weak society, it's easy for communism to come over. And so they have to weaken the family unit. Otherwise, it's much harder for any nation to come conquer. We have a very strong family unit. And I found that very fascinating in my early 20s. And I don't know how old you are, but you don't look very old. And the fact you're picking up on all of this and you're making film to educate the masses, because they have they manipulated our mindset through film, TV, news, etc., to get their ideas across, to do exactly what you just said, to usher in communism. Yeah. And I found that very fascinating. And so when your one film ended up leading to several other things as you dove down the rabbit trails, what I'm hearing.
Yes, exactly. This is admittedly something I didn't totally conceptualize until I released Daughters of the West. And then I looked back over my whole body of work and I actually realized that I've been studying modern warfare throughout my entire career as a content creator. You can go right back. I have a series called Worlds Within on Rise TV. And the first season of that series looks at the metaphysics of warfare and the spiritual knowledge to be gathered from modern warfare and ways of seeing the human experience from the vantage point of modern warfare. So I realized once I released Daughters of the West that this has really been a passion of mine for a long time. And that, you know, I'm on a particular mission to educate the public about modern warfare, because mm-hmm. I think what's important is that we impart to the public situational awareness. And,
yes.
You know, and if people don't have that, they can't take correct action. They can't protect their families. They can't protect themselves. And so, you know, like you were saying with the family, there's lots of information on communists wanting to disrupt the family unit. And I think the most practical way for people to understand that is the family's capacity to gather knowledge and to keep knowledge intact and to move it through the generations. Because what happens is when you don't have stable families, then knowledge of how to live correctly and knowledge of what we've learned in the past, it doesn't get passed on, so that the next generation, all they have to orient themselves are the social engineering structures that are surrounding them, coming in from big tech, from the government. That is their only way to orient themselves, because they don't have knowledge coming from their family. And so they are left extremely available to modern warfare. Mm-hmm. And so it's why the family on this very practical level is very important, because it orients each generation to be able to prepare themselves for what's going on in the world. In this case, we are in a world war made up of fifth generation warfare. Yep. So very specific kind of warfare that is designed to blend into our sociocultural landscape. And so, yeah, like it's been a passion of mine for a long time now. I'm funnily enough, I'm actually 39 today. Today is my birthday.
Oh,
my
39th happy birthday. Birthday. Happy
Strangely
birthday.
Enough.
That's and, wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks and I'm for looking sharing it with us today.
Yeah. I'm glad to, you know, it pleases me to be able to help share these ideas and to orient people because I believe that that is the crucial element that will save girls. And so for me, mm-hmm. getting into the weeds of gender ideology and all that, to an extent, it is necessary for people because there is a push to make this hyper political. Mm-hmm. There's a push to make this seem like if you're right wing enough, you'll defeat this, you know, and the left is given the same talking points that if you move further and further to the left, you'll help save trans kids. And sort of both sides are being fed this idea that if you commit to a more politically charged ideology, you will save children. And in fact, it's quite the opposite in the sense that we need to be networking across the political aisle mm-hmm. because the enemy that we're up against doesn't care about politics.
That's exactly right.
Right? They use politics.
You're a brilliant man. Yes, you're a brilliant man. You are hitting it. Like my shows have been... I started back in a few, well, I've been a broadcaster for a long time. And then I stopped when I had my children. And then God's like, come back. You need to start your show again. And so I started exposing what was happening with the election fraud and the COVID fraud. And then realizing it's all tied into communism and try to do shows about that. And you find the manifestos and you find their ideologies and you find, and you're just like, wow, that is exactly what's happening. I mean, they are like spot on with their warfare against America. And it's very subtle. You know, when we think war, we think kinetic, but the wars nowadays are not, they had to take us from within in order to try and take us down. And I don't think they're going to win. And Canada, I mean, is really under attack, just like America is, because when people think, honestly, when people think of Canada, they do think of America. It's like, it's hard to differentiate in my mind between Canadians and the United States, because I feel like our cultures are very similar. And I feel like we're almost like even though we're two nations, it feels to me as a U.S. citizen that we're just one nation, that, you know, we share so much values that are the same. We believe in freedom and families and things like that. And so but when we saw the trucker convoy and we saw what Trudeau's doing, and they want to you don't have the right to bear arms. And if you do, it's very strict. You're on a list, and all of these things play a part of freedom, and freedom is really under attack. And so I find you very brilliant that you're finding these things and bringing it out in a way that people can understand. So I want to get into your film. So I'm going to show a clip of your film because people are probably still wondering, like, what the heck is Daughters of the West all about? When you see the trailer, you're totally going to understand. And he's going to deep dive into some of the things that are attacking the mindset of the female. So let's check this out.
In August of 2022, Obstetrics and Gynecology reported on the latest demographic characteristics of patients undergoing labiaplasty.
The latest rate in school shopping includes new body parts.
The highest rate of cases was observed among adolescent young women in the United States.
I have to do something crazy that will make me feel happy.
Make me feel happy.
So what this graph shows is they deliberately harmed themselves to the point they had to be hospitalized. So the rate for 15 to 19-year-old girls is up 62% since 2009. Now the youngest girls, these are 10 to 14-year-old girls. It's up 189%. It has nearly tripled in the last 5 or 6 years.
What's the cause?
Confusing them. I mean, confusing them to the level that they would go to the extreme to butcher their own bodies.
Oh. Self-harm has always been more of a girl thing than a boy thing. It's the leading candidate, and the timing, look at that time, is social media. These are 10 to 14-year-old girls. These are preteens. They used to have very low rates.
Starting around the age of 12, I began to believe that I was transgender.
It's like a virus came out of nowhere.
Between 2016 and 2017, the number of gender surgeries for NATO females in the United States quadrupled.
I thought it was about tolerance. I thought these rainbows were nice. I didn't think they were so bad. I didn't see the side of it.
In 2018, the UK reported a 4,400% rise in teenage girls seeking gender treatments.
They didn't used to cut themselves.
It's the sweeping nature of transgender ideology that is overtaking our entire society.
Using their fight or flight, being hijacked.
Everyone has transphobia.
They're being told every day that they're going to die unless something happens.
Would you rather have a dead daughter or a live son?
Do you want a dead daughter or a living son?
No one explored why I did not want to be a girl. Who here really believes that as a 15-year-old, I should have had my healthy breast removed? That should have been an option.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to have kids.
There are interest groups that benefit from taking advantage of individuals' fight or flight mechanisms on a daily basis.
They didn't used to cut themselves.
And you can't go back. I'm ruined.
I have to do something crazy that would make me feel happy.
Oh, man. That just broke my heart. It's just, that's hard to watch, you know, because what I have noticed too is that they do go after the most vulnerable people that are in a really bad place mentally, people that are really hurting, and say, this is going to be the answer. This is going to be the solution. And I base that on just people I've interviewed that have been a transgender that was deeply wounded by somebody or something, deeply wounded, and they thought the only answer was to change the outside appearance. And they said that that was the worst thing that ever happened to them, because transitioning back was a lot harder than the first transition, they said. And then when it comes to being intimate with somebody, it was very difficult for them to become intimate once they reverted back to their natural gender. And so someone who has infertility survivor, someone who's tried really hard to have children, finally was able to have children, that part gets me the most, that they are ruining the ability down the road for someone to have children. Because as a teenager, and I know I'm guilty of this, I told my parents I never want to have kids. And then I met my husband, fell in love, and wanted to start a family with him. That changed. Why? Because I was an immature teenage girl with not a mature brain. And then as I grew older and fell in love and had a good relationship, I wanted to have children. And it took us a very long time, but at least we were able to have kids. So my heart goes to all these people that as adolescents and teenagers, and that's the farthest thing from their mind, when it someday when their brain matures and they find somebody, that's already been taken from them.
You know, this is a big part of why I made Superorganism. We need to have culture that uplifts the power and the importance of family. That's nowhere in the culture for children. So of course, like on the one hand, you just have the fact of just being a teenager, there is the immaturity. And so a lot of teenagers just aren't going to go there. But at the same time, there's nothing in our culture that teaches teenagers how incredible starting a family is. You know, unless they're being given, really one of the only resources would be like a Christian upbringing that might do right. that. But we need it in broader cultural terms. It needs to be celebrated like other things are celebrated in our culture. But because our culture has been weaponized against us, they're not growing up with this idea that starting a family is an incredible thing. It's something I'm instilling into my children, saying like to my sons, you know, it'd be incredible if you could be a father one day. It's so amazing. And talking about it openly. This needs to be given to children, especially young girls, because their capacity to bear children, this is the drive of our whole species. This is a very powerful, powerful thing that their bodies can do. And the choice not to enact that capacity is a serious one. And they should be raised with the context of that culturally. Because this is the thing, is that parents can only do so much, because children are cultural sponges. They will soak up the culture around them. There's no getting around it. There's no amount of sheltering them or homeschooling them that's going to stop that. So all you can do is try to support them as much as you can and give them the ability to think freely within the context of our culture. But at the same time, there are those of us who are creators of culture and who are trying to create this cultural pushback who need to be developing content that uplifts the family ideal in as many ways as we can. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with Superorganism. And it's one of the reasons I want to help educate people on what's happening to girls beyond just gender ideology. Because as my film shows, it's not just about gender ideology, right? Their minds are being warped. Like, you know that clip in the trailer where there's the fake cutting of the girl's
hand. Yes, that got me. That got me.
Okay, so
yeah,
there's a story behind that, actually.
Okay, tell me the story.
This is from a Miley Cyrus music video. Okay, that's where I got that clip. So you need to ask yourself, because Miley Cyrus, this is someone who, there's literally articles saying that she is a feminist icon. So you know that preteens and teenage girls are looking up to her. They're watching her videos. They're taking, they're consuming what she's putting out. Why would you produce a video for children and young minds that has this graphic image of a girl cutting her own fingers off, right? This is the theme of my film, this idea of cut. These weird, dark messages, this messaging is embedded everywhere in all sorts of ways. Gender ideology is just a culmination of it. But of course, we also have the problem of girls cutting themselves because they're depressed. We also have the problem of a rising number of girls getting cosmetic genital surgery to try to modify their labia because of what they're being told, not just in pornography and mainstream media, but even by the medical establishment itself. They're saying that the majority of girls have deformed labia anyway, so that labiaplasty is appropriate. So
oh, I funny. Wish they wouldn't do that because, like, yeah. that's how females, you know, enjoy yep. their intimate time with their husband, right? And exactly. I wish they wouldn't do that. I wish they wouldn't do that because it is, that's just a very sad thing because when you're finally in a committed relationship and that is the most intimate time you're ever going to have with anybody ever. And that is so special, so special. And we, you know what, as a culture, we have indoctrinated people that it really isn't as special, that you should just do it with everyone and anyone you're dating because it's not really that important. You're just getting your urges out. These are the messages that we're getting, but the sad thing is all these messages have been destroying the family unit because now we have a lot of single parents households. And plus also socially, you know, they've had all these social programs to kick dads out. Oh, you don't need a dad. The state will take care of you. Don't worry, single moms. The state will take care of you. Yeah, they will. And they'll indoctrinate your kids while taking care of you. That, you know, I noticed as a young girl, they were attacking dads. It's heavily in the 90s. Like
yes.
dads were stupid. Buffoons. Dads didn't know anything. It was always the mom that knew everything. The mom was the hero. And I'm a mom. Like I'm not stupid, but neither is my husband. He is a very intelligent person. I look at him to bounce ideas off. I go to him for advice. I go to him for protection. You know, he helps with the discipline in the home. He builds the confidence in my children's lives. He is very useful, but on TV, he's an idiot. And I noticed that early on and I started getting angry about that because I didn't like that portrayal of men in every single TV show in the 90s.
This is something that I outlined in Superorganism. So the way I broke that series out was I did two episodes focusing on children and innocence, two episodes focusing on fathers and men, and two episodes focusing on mothers and women. And in the fathers, you know, the warfare on the fathers is something I get into extensively because they're not only framing men as these buffoons incapable mm-hmm. of rearing their own children, but they're actually ignoring the science of fatherhood. And this is very important. There is a science to fatherly devotion. There are things that happen in men's bodies when they devote themselves to a pregnant woman. They are deeply impacted on a physiological level by this. So one of the most beautiful things is that when a man is devoted to a pregnant woman, her body essentially is generating a biofield. Hmm. And the way her body is changing according to the development of the baby, it starts to change the father's body in terms of hormones and things like this. The father's moods fluctuate along with the mother's, but there's more poignant things they've studied. For example, if a father is devoted, and devoted means really present, like he's actually present mm-hmm. in the field of the mom's body during the pregnancy, he's there, he's supportive. So his body starts to respond. It does things like increasing the amount of prolactin in the father's body. Mm-hmm. And in these studies, they found that the fathers who did this and they had this rise in prolactin, after their child was born, it caused their bodies to be more responsive to their baby's cries. And so literally the father devoting himself during the gestation period is reprogramming his body and creating a connection between him and his child. So the mom's body is acting like a bridge, creating that first bond with the father and the child based on his presence. But if the father is absent, he's actually missing out on his body being reprogrammed by the mothers. So there's a science to this. And again, like, we have non-religious ways of uplifting this information. You know, we have ways of presenting this to everyone that could become cultural staples, but this information is obscure to most people, and it's very important. And so, you know, when you look at what devotion to a family, to a child really means, this is something that I believe, you know, after making Daughters of the West, what I've come to realize is one of the best ways you can protect your kids is by being more devoted to them as they are as individuals. So not in a way that is dogmatic through a parenting system or in a religion, but actually knowing your child so deeply that you understand where they might be able to be coerced by what's out there. Because even though what's happening with girls right now is a trend and it's spreading like a social contagion, it's still also true that each girl that is doing this to herself is doing this according to her own struggles, her own weaknesses, her own pain, her own trauma. It is unique to her. And so when a father and a mother are deeply devoted to that specific child, their ability to protect her is going to be much more uplifted. But if you have this modern way of life where the kid is at school all day, you see them for a little bit at dinner, then everyone goes away to their rooms and they all go onto their screens, and you don't have that deep connection with your child, they are going to be available to this warfare on levels that you won't be able to perceive until it's too late.
Now, dive into that a little bit about the different levels of the attack, especially against the children. I know what it was like for me as a junior high girl. The girls are so cruel. I mean, one day they're my friends, one day they're not my friends. One day my hair looks great, the other it looks terrible. They would make fun of my clothes one day, and one day they'd be my best friend. It was such a roller coaster being a teenage girl, and it was really hard. I became anorexic. That's what it did to me as a teenage girl, and then I was able to bounce back from that. So I understand it's really, they're targeting girls at the most vulnerable they're ever going to be.
That's
and
right.
That adolescence, you know, going into your teenage years, this is the most vulnerable they're ever going to be. And what, so talk to us about the warfare going on there and the different strategies.
What you're talking about is very, very poignant. And this is something I get into deeply in the film. Girls, they rely on their social cluster in terms of developing their sense of self very, very deeply. Girls are social in ways that boys are not. So there's a number of things going on here that are very important to recognize. Number one, this is why we can fairly confidently say that this explosion of trans girls is a social contagion, because girls historically have always lent themselves to social contagions. Throughout history, we have examples of it. We have explosions of anorexia, explosions of cutting. We can go right back to the Salem witch trials. This was a social contagion that spread throughout girls specifically. And you had a very similar situation where ideologically captured adults, they submitted themselves to these girls who were spreading this social contagion, and they used what these mentally ill girls were saying as foundations for truth, and they executed people according to what these girls were saying. So there's a history to girls and social contagion. So that's fundamental to understand. There's a study that I point to in the film by Dr. Lisa Littman that the mainstream media, who is very beholden to gender ideology, tried to attack, tried to suppress. They tried to end all discussion about the gender craze as a social contagion. So that's important to recognize. The other element of this warfare is social media. And because girls are of this nature, socially and in the way that they develop, giving them social media in junior high, in middle school, has been absolutely devastating. And this is a brand new thing to the human race, and people need to understand this. I present some research in the film specifically about this, that we have never given smartphones and social media to middle school children, specifically middle school girls. And the middle school girls who were the first generation to be exposed to that are also the girls who exploded into this transgender craze. It is the same generation. It is also the same generation where we have preteens cutting themselves at record rates to the point that they are being hospitalized. It went up by 160%. Again, in alignment with the introduction of social media and smartphones to this younger age group, because before that, it was only high schoolers who had access to this. And so the drop of age here, giving social media and smartphones from high school into junior high, into middle school, This had a severe impact on the mental health of girls. So we have a lot of factors coalescing here. We have our cultural staples that have for generations told women that their bodies need to be modified for them to be who they are. This is an old idea. This is the history of cosmetic surgery, which I also-
90s was a big push for that.
Huge, huge. That message was pushed in the 90s aggressively. And what's happened is over the generations, it has trickled into younger and younger ages. So we have that foundation, right? Then girls are given social media and smartphones. At the same time, the social media, the schools, and the mainstream media are all saturated with gender ideology. The medical literature is saturated with disinformation about girls' labia and labiaplasty. We have a lot of conflating factors that all girls are now up against. And this is the mix of factors that is attacking the Daughters of the West. And it's why it's not a political issue. A lot of these issues, cosmetic surgery targeting young girls is not a political issue.
No.
And this is important. It's why I released this film, because if you're a right-wing person looking to speak to someone on the left, then you can just start with the fact that they are disinforming girls about their actual anatomy, not giving them the proper information for these cosmetic surgeries. They are coercing and lying to girls. So let's say a girl's on TikTok. She's potentially seeing actual ads to go get labiaplasty. Mm. She's seeing memes that say that if your labia look a certain way, it means that you're slutty or that you have damaged labia, that you're deformed, all sorts of disinformation. So they're coming from this cultural space where there's disinformation. Then they're going to the doctor who is also disinforming them and passing on this absolutely false medical literature. And then the cosmetic surgeons, they are actually, and I show this in the film too, they are against parents who don't want to consent to this. Their commitment is to the girl who says, I want the labiaplasty, not to the parents who say, I don't want my daughter to have this.
So, and this is how easy it is for a good parent to have their kids removed. It's called medical kidnapping, or even in the school system, because this is a fundamental belief now that some of these grownups truly have. They truly have this belief inside of them that you are harming your child if you do not agree to this surgery that's transforming the appearance on the outside. It does not transform the inside of a person. A female's brain is still going to work the same as if she looked like a female on the outside. Same thing with a male brain. It's been told to me that a male brain kind of works in compartments, where a female's brain is kind of like spaghetti. You know, they just function differently. The men is more logical. The female is more emotional. You just said it yourself. Females have this more social capacity, which I know to be true because I'm a female. So I know that to be true, right? Where men are able to be more like alone, not like they're not social creatures at all, but in a different way than females. It's just different. Men and women are just different, but it doesn't make us bad or good. It just makes us unique and different to complement one another.
They want to present this idea that gender is just a social construct, and it is fundamentally false, but there's been a very successful disinformation campaign that confuses people very, very deeply. And it's important to understand the language that they're using and the kind of manipulations that are going on. So for example, you have in the UK, in Sweden, in Norway, in Finland, they are all pushing back against the gender affirmative medical model, but it's important that we specifically identify what that really means, because the gender affirmative model is kind of a broad term. And so there's a lot of media trying to mislead people saying, no, the gender affirmative model is still being practiced in the UK. That's a lie. So I'll get very, very specific with people. WPATH, okay, this is the organization, this is the World Organization for Gender Affirmative Care. They're the ones who are trying to set these medical standards. WPATH is actually not a scientific organization. They're an activist organization framed as a scientific organization. They, in 2010, released a statement saying that we need to depathologize gender incongruence. And what that means is they don't believe that it should ever be assessed as a mental health issue in any way. This is after decades and decades of research identified gender dysphoria as a mental illness that needs treatment as a mental illness.
Correct.
And so they are asking the world to dismiss that entire body of work. And so when we say radical gender affirmative care, what we really mean is nations who are following WPATH's push to depathologize gender incongruence, And so that means removing all barriers for mental health. And anytime a child says, I don't feel like I'm my gender, you immediately, you affirm them and you help them get towards the medicalized treatment that would help affirm what they're feeling. So this is the difference between nations like the UK, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and nations like Canada and America. Okay. In the UK, they have put up serious barriers to say that, no, this is mental health first, that has to be assessed first. Mm-hmm. They have put up firm barriers saying that to access puberty blockers for children, you are going to need to be a participant in a formal research setting. The parents will have to consent the child into this research experimental setting. Whereas in Canada and America, there are children being put on puberty blockers not only without that research context, but without parental consent at all. In Canada, there's lots of examples of children being put on puberty blockers without the parental consent. Or in America, you can look at Planned Parenthood. A girl can come into Planned Parenthood self-diagnosed with gender dysphoria. She can walk out that day with testosterone. So when we say that the gender affirmative model is being ended in these other nations, that is the heart of what we mean. The nations that are pushing back against WPATH's intention to try to take away the history of gender dysphoria medicine and to try to say there should be no mental health assessment at all. And so that's what we're looking at. Canada and America are definitely the most radical. They are, all the institutions here are captured and are pushing this WPATH agenda, whereas those other nations are not. And that's important when we want to debate people and talk about this. It's important to look at those nations and what specifically they're pushing back against so that someone can't just be like, well, they're still practicing gender affirmative care, when really the heart of it is that WPATH statement from 2010.
And the attack on the parents is so real. Like I just said, the medical kidnapping, the CPS getting called on you if your school teacher decides or the school counselor decides you're not affirming their gender. Really, that's none of their business. If you are otherwise treating your child well, you provide for them meals and shelter and you love them and you're not beating them, and you're not mentally harming them, then really they need a butt out. It's not their child, it's your child. And if your child is dealing with gender issues, it's nobody else's business but your own. And those people need a butt out. That's my opinion. They need a butt out. And what they're trying to wreck families right now by easily trying to take your kid. And also subvert your parental rights. The parental rights are under severe attack in Canada, in America, severely, severely under attack. And so these are your children, but the state, whoever's in charge, really believes your child belongs to them. And you've pointed out there's been a progression. So this has been probably a long plan in place. This isn't just something poof that came overnight, because you have to boil the frog in the water so it doesn't jump out. So I know from the 90s, them pushing the plastic surgery with all the girls in bikinis with the big breasts and the augmented lips and also the Kardashians. I mean, girls look up to the Kardashians, and all of them have underwent plastic surgery. And then you see them on TV going through plastic surgery. And so it's just been a progression, because this has been the ultimate. They want to depopulate the earth. They want to destroy the family. They want to take away your rights. They want to usher in communism.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a 1984 interview with a communist defector named Yuri Bezmenov. And it's a really important interview for people to watch, because he outlines the communist plan in terms of infiltration into North America. And what he speaks to is doing this over three generations, so that by the third generation, you have people who cannot think critically, they cannot think freely. And even if you present them with basic logical facts, they actually can't see them, because they are captured by behavioral science that is well understood. And so Bezmenov outlines the communist intention to do this in America with great precision. And it's precisely what we're seeing. It's like you talked about, the slow boiling of the frog in the water. It's about doing it over generations so that this warfare is invisible to us, so that eventually you have these radicals in positions of power who cannot actually perceive reality, they cannot be argued with, they cannot be debated with, they are captured by a form of very advanced modern communist warfare. And so this is important that again, we need situational awareness here, because there are some people we're going to be able to talk to, there's some people we're not going to be able to talk to. However, I will also state that there are some exceptions to Bezmenov's rule that there are people who get captured like this who can never come back, because we have an example of the opposite occurring in detransitioners, right? Mm-hmm. When we look at detransitioners, they were captured in the exact way that Yuri Bezmenov describes, right? They couldn't see the black is black and white is white. They couldn't perceive it. They were so ideologically captured that they maimed their own bodies. They sterilized themselves. They permanently damaged their bodies, but they woke up to the warfare. They came out of the mind control and they are now sharing their stories, which mm-hmm. is why from a warfare perspective, the stories of detransitioners are very important to uplift, to understand, to share, because they are actual examples of emerging from communist mind control. And mm-hmm. we need them to speak from direct experience here, because that is a good way to create a pathway for people who are captured out of that ideological subversion that mm-hmm. Bezmenov describes. So, you know, to me, it's always about thinking in terms of warfare, of what's strategic, what is going to help save girls, and finding those ways, those bridges to reach out to the left from the right, and even vice versa sometimes. You know, sometimes I see left-wing people calling right-wing people to be a little less extreme in the way that they're framing it, right? In saying that all left-wing people agree with gender affirmative care, because yeah, that's not true. No. Right, you have a lot of left-wing people who are against this. And so correct. It is really important that we reach out across the aisle. I had an experience with this the other day where I was connected with a woman on Twitter named Jessica Pinn. And she, for decades now, has been fighting to expose all the medical disinformation leading girls to get labiaplasties. She was the victim of a botched labiaplasty, and it permanently damaged her sexual function. And so she's been outspoken about this for years. But it's interesting because she is framed by the left more within this classical feminist context. Mm-hmm. And so her work has been shared by the New York Times. She's been on The Daily Show. She's been on all these mainstream left-wing outlets. But now the work that she's doing, it's starting to have this crossover, right? It's starting to blend into this war on girls that seems to be to many a political war when it's not. And interestingly, she's now being attacked by the trans mob as transphobic just for pointing out the reality of female anatomy. And so we yep. see here, right? We see where it's not really political.
I was just going to say that the trans organization, not like the people itself, not like the you and me that are getting surgery. I'm talking about the bigger picture here, the bigger people on top who are really pushing this. They are attacking the detransitioners like crazy. Yes. Why aren't you celebrating the fact that someone is finding themselves again, like loving themselves again? Why are you attacking? Are we only supposed to love people who are changing their gender? We are not allowed to love people who are coming out of that and just taking back the biological gender they were born with. I mean, the attack on the detransitioners is huge. And you know what? I feel so awful for them, because the ones I've spoken to, they said it's a harder surgery to overcome. Yeah. And then you're being attacked by the community that once loved you, and now you're being attacked by them. I mean, they're in a really tough spot.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The attacks on the detransitioners, it speaks volumes. Number one, when it comes from media sources, to me, that exposes those mainstream media sources as warfare operations, because there's really no logical reason to be doing that when you have, if you were really a media organization that was just trying to factually report on things, you wouldn't be writing hit pieces about Chloe Cole. It doesn't make any sense, right? So you have that perspective of, okay, that seems like a warfare operation. But number two, it identifies some of these radicals online. If you go and you look at the Twitter feed of people like Chloe Cole being attacked, some of these people, they are those radicals that Yuri Bezmenov described. They are examples of that, of people who just, they cannot see logic or facts. They are captured by warfare that took generations. And so they are victims of this warfare. They have lost their minds to it. So we need to redefine casualties of war to an extent. These radicals, even though a lot of us may feel triggered by them and sickened by them, and want to shame them and attack them. It is important to see them as victims of war that took generations, right? So that person's mind, the mechanics of taking that person's mind from them started three generations ago. That is a very, very difficult thing to be up against. And so how could that person possibly know that their mind is the result of multi-generational warfare? Correct. That's a hard thing for them to even conceive of. It's a hard thing for any of us to conceive of, because to an extent, we are all victims of that. All of us have multi-generational social engineering that we are undoing and trying to unlearn as we wake up to this war. Technically, we're all there in one way or another. And so it's important to humble ourselves and to recognize that there is no escaping this warfare. We are all saturated by it. The best we can do is cultivate free thinking, situational awareness, and try to find compassionate ways to move through this. And the compassion piece really, it is uplifted by being able to tactically displace your political identity and political narratives when they don't serve what's going on. And
COVID was a good example of this, where a lot of people were, I hate to use the word brainwashed, but really, I don't know any other word to say it, because the realities of what COVID did were not true, what they were saying. And there was some people that knew enough and saw the red flags and like, there's something else going around here. And then when they didn't comply, then they became the enemies of, and people were very angry and hurt them and disengaged with them, wouldn't let them come over, et cetera, et cetera. We could see that, just like you're saying. So mass scale, like, we want to think it's impossible for us to be brainwashed. They have learned to weaponize the human brain for so many decades, like you said. They know it like a science. Okay, so we shouldn't feel so bad about ourselves if we fall for it, because these are people who have been perfecting it for a very long time to target against us. But I want to go into boys, because boys are also being affected by this. So can you go in? I know your film's about females, and I'm so glad you're doing that. But how are boys being affected? How are they targeting boys in this to want to change a boy from being a boy to a girl? How's that attack going?
Well, the attack on masculinity is in essence the heart of that. The idea that masculinity is inherently toxic is drilled into boys. You have, you know, if you have just like a white boy at school, right? He's being attacked by this from numerous angles. He has critical race theory saying that his whiteness means he's evil and dangerous. And then, you know, he has gender theory saying that his masculinity is dangerous. So a young boy is being targeted by these ideologies on that fundamental psychological level. And while it's not leading to an explosion in boys transitioning like it is girls, it's leading to, you know, two things, I would say. Number one, for some boys, it is leading to the transition. And I think we can say from the decades of research on gender dysphoria, the majority of boys being transitioned, they are boys who would likely grow up to just be gay men. And so what you're actually having is it's very homophobic what's going on, because boys who would just become gay men are being transitioned at a young age instead of being allowed to develop into gay men. This is what the studies show. So there's, you know, there's a particular study that I've looked into very deeply. It comes from here in Toronto where I am. And it's one of the longest, largest studies on gender dysphoria. And it's important to recognize that the explosion in girls with gender dysphoria and all this, that's brand new to science. Because the history of gender dysphoria shows that it was boys. It was almost entirely boys for decades and decades, to the extent that there was no medical literature on gender dysphoria in girls until 2012. Okay, it's brand new. So the history of gender dysphoria is actually rooted in boys. And this particular study, they followed boys with clinical gender dysphoria from childhood into adulthood. So it was about a 34-year span on average, where they followed up with these boys, and they found that almost 90% of them, once they were adults, desisted from their gender dysphoria. That means they no longer had gender dysphoria. They were comfortable in their natal bodies by the time they were adults. And the majority of those 90% of boys that desisted actually just turned out to be gay men. And so this is what we're actually dealing with. So that this is why you have groups like Gays Against Groomers who are speaking out so strongly, because they're seeing that gay youth, gay and lesbian youth are being targeted by this. They're being transitioned instead of being allowed to just become gay and lesbian youth. Their bodies are being transformed. They're being harmed. They're being told, if you have these preferences, well, you must be the other gender instead of just, you know, because like a lot of boys who end up being gay men, they're flamboyant in their youth. And that's always been, that's human history. We've always seen that, right? This is not new. So there's that element of it. There is also a cultural feminization of boys that's going on, right? And so you have that, like, I've seen a lot of videos lately, like stores like Target, where all the boys' clothes are pink with rainbows and butterflies, right? And like they're trying to take away anything that is seemingly masculine. And so there is that element of it. There is potentially also a biological element to it, where you have a lot of plastics, and substances in our environment, in our foods that act as what are called xenoestrogens. And so xenoestrogens, they mimic the behavior of estrogen in the human body. So they can make it so that a boy's body is more saturated by these estrogen-like substances. Mm-hmm. So you do have a lot going on that is definitely impacting boys. And I think a lot of this also, it goes back to that multi-generational perspective of men and fathers being stupid buffoons. So that the ideal of fatherhood is not handed to young boys. It's not, they're not told it's totally epic and incredible to be a dad. They're not given that idea. They're given this notion that dads are kind of bumbling idiots. And so, you know, all of those, again, we're looking at many, many conflating factors over a long period of time that are culminating right now and need to be identified. This is why I'm a part of something called Dad Army, and I work closely with Mom Army. We are very committed to ending the war on innocence, on children, the war on men and women and the family. And so we are doing a big push right now. And I encourage people to look up Mom Army and Dad Army. If you go to mom-army.com, you can get connected with all our work. And we're actually involved with a lot of boots on the ground work, getting bills passed to protect parental rights, to stop the medicalization of children's bodies, to end the normalization of pedophilia. There's a lot that we are doing to actually try to fight back, because it's going to take all hands on deck.
Going back to what you said about a dad, man, a dad is so important to both girls and boys. And the fact that there's kids that aren't like young boys, like you're raising a boy, I'm raising a boy. And I want him to be feeling good about who he is as a boy, that he is tough and there's nothing wrong with being tough. He was made to be strong, to be a protector, to be a comforter in a way. Like, the, you know, if I'm so brokenhearted, it's my husband that makes me feel the best. No other female can make me feel safe, secure, and protected like he can. There's great qualities about being a dad. My dad made me feel like I was so beautiful, and he set a standard of how, you know, I should expect men to treat me. And I knew he would be there no matter what. If I really had a hard day, like having his hugs meant everything. And for a boy looking up, because the lack of fathers in the home, like what is a boy to do? How is he, who's he supposed to look after? To be a role model of what is, what does it take to be a dad? How does it, what, how am I supposed to act in the world being a man? I mean, there's so many questions that if you don't have a good male role model, it leaves the boys very, very lost, very lost. And I think we need to protect our boys just as much as we protect our girls. And I think oftentimes we don't think about boys need just as much protection as girls, which is something that society has taught us for many decades. Oh, you don't have to worry about a boy. He's going to be fine. Just no, our boys need to be protected just as much as our little girls, because the attack on a boy's is different, but they're being attacked just the same. And I want him, I want my son to grow up to know that he's valued in society and that what he thinks and does matters to people. And I want him to be a good dad to his children someday. And I want him to be a loving husband to his wife someday. You know, I want this for my son. I want a bright future for him. And so I want to thank you for being a part of that Dad Army / Mom Army in your films, because we need to get back to a core. They've been trying to break up the family for a long time with pushing the idea of just wait till after college to get married. Just wait till after college to have kids. I don't see any reason why you can't start a family, be married, and go to college. I was married and I went to college and I finished just fine. Because the generation before is like our parents and our grandparents' generation. They got married right out of high school. They had kids at a young age. It wasn't telling them, oh, just fulfill all your lives and then have children. Because you get to a certain point where sometimes your reproductive systems don't work as great when you're older. And it's harder to get pregnant. And it's harder to carry a baby when you're older. Where when you're younger, you're more fertile. It's easier for younger women to carry a baby. So we've had that too. I mean, it's been a multi-level push, attack against the family, and they're very subtle. Very subtle.
Yeah. The subtlety is so important to recognize. And I think, you know, that it takes some ability to hold doubt and to be able to think with nuance. I think when we can't be in spaces comfortably with doubt, and if we can't enter into nuance, then we're going to struggle. You know, for example, like there were some fatherly ideals in our culture that were sustained, but some of them had to do with just men working nonstop and not being present. And some of them were coming from like, I'm just trying to provide, right? I'm just trying to provide. And they end up overworking and they end up being absent from the children's lives, not recognizing what fatherly devotion really means. And I think, you know, getting back to some of that science of fatherhood, what if men were taught that your body gets reprogrammed if you're more present, if you're there, that it actually upgrades you so that you're naturally more responsive to your children? This is just a gift from nature that's right there available to you. If you're just present, it will do it for you. The men in these studies, they didn't know that this was happening. They had no idea their bodies are being transformed. They had to then be shown the research after to be like, hey, check it out. Your body's totally different now. And so for them, this was like, you know, it was a very shocking, interesting thing. There was another aspect of these studies where they showed that men, the first time they held their newborn babies, there was a temporary drop in their testosterone by 33%. Mm-hmm. And the way they frame this is that the man's emotional landscape changes in that moment. His competitiveness and his aggression drop, and he becomes more emotionally available to that child in that moment of first bonding. And that can radically change the father. So there are opportunities for fathers to use nature and their design to advantage, to become better dads, that it will uplift them. So, you know, again, we need subtlety and nuance so that even the father who is stuck in this idea that I need to like work nonstop can reel things back and understand things from that broader, more nuanced perspective.
Oh, I love that. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you and all the research you've done, and your films sound incredible. So thank you for all your hard work you've done. I appreciate you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And I really encourage people to check out daughtersofthewestfilm.com. You can pre-order the film right now. We are releasing the film on April 15th. We are doing a world premiere at a cinema in Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona. There are tickets for that as well. That's going to be a fundraiser for the Gavel Project, which is
I love the Gavel Project. I interviewed the attorney there.
Yeah, Ryan. Ryan is amazing. He's in my film. I get into one of his key cases that's fighting to get justice for Sage, who's a little girl who was deeply harmed by gender ideology. So we're actually using the world premiere to raise funds for the Gavel Project. So I encourage people, if you're in the area or if you want to purchase a ticket for someone who's in the area to help raise funds for the Gavel Project, you can do that to get people in seats at the world premiere on the 15th. And you can pre-order the film online. And I also want to say that at daughtersofthewestfilm.com, I've created a resource section that is specifically to help guide parents and families and girls struggling from the harms of all of this. And so you can go into that library that I'm constantly adding to, and it will help you navigate it, get access to therapy and legal resources, literature that helps children without gender ideology being a part of it. It's a growing list that will give you, you know, networks of parents who are struggling with this as well. So the point of everything I'm doing is to save girls. And so if you support this film, if you go to the website, then you're helping fight back against all of this. And the more people support my work, the more films I can make that are proper warfare to help us respond.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for everything, coming on the show. I appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.